you a rundown of what it is that we're going to be listening to on tonight's during the prepared portion of tonight's program. I'm going to begin by touching ever so briefly, I'm simply going to read the jacket notes, to a very good new book, which I was given by a listener, a very generous listener, sent me a copy of this book. It is a subject that I have covered in a miscellaneous archive show called Euthanasia in Nazi Germany and Contemporary America. This new book is called The Nazi Connection, subtitled Eugenics, American Racism and German National Socialism. It's authored by Stefan Kuhl, K-U-Umlaut-H-L. It's published in hardcover by the Oxford University Press and copyrighted 1994. Once again, this book is called The Nazi Connection, Eugenics, American Racism and German National Socialism. It's authored by Stefan Kuhl. It's an excellent book. I have not finished reading it. It has a wealth of very, very good information, and I strongly recommend that listeners who feel that Nazism and fascism are something alien to America get a hold of this and understand. It will give you a very good understanding of the international eugenics movement, the international euthanasia movement, and how many of the intellectual movements which gave rise to the Holocaust and the slaughter programs of Nazi Germany in fact had their very profound components in American intellectual life. The intellectual movements which gave rise to the Nazi extermination programs are not by any means alien to the United States. We're going to start off by touching ever so briefly on that book this evening. After that, we're going to turn to a column from the San Francisco Examiner that ran. It's going to air this evening. It was run this past Monday. I have for many years been warning about the coming of fascism to America, and in 1992 I did a massive archive show, which I personally consider to be my finest piece of work. It's called How the United States Lost the Second World War. This particular column talks about how Germany won the Second World War. It's headlined, Germans, the Uninvited Guests of D-Day, and it's subtitled, No One Wants to Admit That Germany Won World War II. Well, perhaps they should have said almost no one, because, in fact, I have said exactly that. And we're going to begin, we're going to begin the reading portion of the prepared portion of tonight's program by reading this particular column by a European correspondent for Scripps Howard News Service. After that, we're going to take a look at an article that is dealing with the city of Kaliningrad, which is still part of Russia. However, it was the former capital of East Prussia, and it is being targeted by the German intelligence service, the BND, as we have seen in the past, for incorporation into a Greater Reich. There's an article from the New York Times this past Friday talking about Kaliningrad and asking, is the city acquiring a German accent? Well, the answer is most definitely yes. Affirmative, it is. This New York Times story, characteristically, however, does not talk about the BND program to promote the emigration of Russians of German extraction to Kaliningrad by way of eventually teasing it away from Russia and incorporating it into a greater German Reich. After that, we're going to touch on a detail concerning the recent speech by an American diplomat that was very critical of Germany. We touched on that speech before. In fact, a week or two ago, I guess we read that last week, the article about the speech that this particular diplomat named Douglas Jones made just prior to retiring. There was, however, an element to his speech that was not carried in the Bay Area papers, but was carried in the New York Times of April 19th. Among the critical comments that Douglas Jones had to make was the observation that the recent proposal made by Wolfgang Schäuble of the CDU-CSU to use the German army in a domestic law enforcement capacity. This was viewed with great alarm by Mr. Jones, and we have touched on that in the past in our discussions with Professor Wilhelm Stauffer of Stauffer Consultants. After that, we're going to delve into a book about Meir Kahane, the extremist of the late Meir Kahane, the extremist rabbi who was the rabbi in his time, and his followers to this day have been, along with their counterparts, the Palestinian extremists, have been thorns in the side of the Middle East peace process. In the first part of a miscellaneous archive show entitled Strange Bedfellows, this done on March 6th of 1994, we went into the connections between elements of the Zionist movement and the fascist powers of Europe. We also delineated, once again, the profound connections between elements of various Middle Eastern nationalist groups, including Palestinian nationalists, with the fascist powers of Europe, as well as the collaborative pattern between black separatist movements, such as the Marcus Garvey Organization and the Nation of Islam of first Elijah Muhammad and later Louis Farrakhan, and their extremist counterparts in the white supremacist movement, such as the Ku Klux Klan, the American Nazi Party of George Lincoln Rockwell, and the Aryan Nations. What we're going to be taking a look at this evening is, and that what we're going to be doing is making a significant addendum to that miscellaneous archive show entitled False Prophet, entitled, not The False Prophet, that's the title of the book, entitled Strange Bedfellows. A listener xeroxed off some long extracts from a recent book about Meir Kahane. It's called The False Prophet. It's authored by Robert Friedman, who is the same individual who has authored the articles in the Village Voice about the U.S. intelligence connections of Sheikh Rahman, whose milieu is being fingered as the culprits in the World Trade Center bombing, as well as the July 4th plot to blow up landmarks and commuter tunnels and commit assassinations in New York City. In that miscellaneous archive show entitled Strange Bedfellows, I fingered Rabbi Kahane and his supporters as the successors, at least ideologically, to the Beit Harim and to the other fascist elements of the Zionist movement. The Zionist movement, like the Palestinian National Movement, is by no means monolithic, and many of its elements had been affiliated in the past with fascism, and the fascist connections of the more extreme elements of the Zionist movement have grown into, an extremist wing of the Zionist movement, which unfortunately held sway in Israel for a long time. Little did I know at the time that, in fact, Meir Kahane and his followers are directly connected to the Beit Harim and the other fascist Zionists. In fact, Vladimir Yabotinsky, the head of the Beitar, was actually a guest at the Kahane home when Meir Kahane was a young boy. Both Meir Kahane and many of his reactionary associates then joined the Beit Harim. And we're going to take a look at the political resume of the late Rabbi Meir Kahane this evening by way of adding to the Strange Bedfellows archive show begun on March 6th. First of all, we're going to take a look at the connecting links between the Kahane family and Vladimir Yabotinsky, the head of the Beit Harim, the head of the Beitar, a fascist element of the Zionist movement. The Beitar was actually an international organization. It collaborated with, among others, Mussolini. We're going to take a look at the Kahane-Yabotinsky connections to begin the broadcast this evening. After that, we're going to take a look at one of the primary influences on Meir Kahane, namely a Syrian-American Jew named Joseph Cherba, who not only became a functionary an operative for U.S. intelligence, but also became a national security advisor to former President Ronald Reagan during the 1980 campaign. Cherba was very close to, among others, Air Force intelligence, and it was Joseph Cherba, a fellow member along with Meir Kahane of the Beitar, who introduced Meir Kahane to not only the ranks of the American far right, but also the ranks of the American intelligence community as well. What we're going to be looking at for much of the broadcast this evening are the operational connections between Meir Kahane and his milieu and the American far right, some of these elements explicitly fascist, and the U.S. intelligence community. We're going to be taking a look at the connecting links between people like Kahane and Joseph Cherba to Moon-sponsored organizations. That's the Reverend Sun Myung Moon, such as the Center for International Security, a powerful Washington think tank. We're going to take a look at the beginnings of Meir Kahane's involvement with the U.S. intelligence community. He began working for U.S. intelligence, posing as a journalist. We're also going to take a look at a movement set up by Meir Kahane and the aforementioned Joseph Cherba called the July 4th Movement. This was an American intelligence front which was designed to generate support among American college students for the Vietnam War. Interestingly enough, some of the people involved with providing support to the July 4th movement were people like Jay Lovestone and Irving Brown, longtime CIA labor operatives, whose political resumes go all the way back to the immediate post-World War II period, when those individuals were instrumental in channeling CIA money to organize crime elements in Italy and in France in order to combat the communist dock workers and communist elements in the labor movement. One of the unforeseen outgrowths of that relationship was the sanctity of the heroin refineries in those countries, which ultimately led to the formation of the very famous French connection, heroin connection, between Europe, Southern Europe, and the United States. I. Irving Brown's son, Robert Brown, as well as a later luminary of the American far right named Roy Godson, heavily involved with, among other things, the Contra support effort, were among the running mates, the associates of Joseph Cherba and Meyer Kahane in the July 4th movement. Again, a Vietnam-era U.S. intelligence front and designed to generate support for the Vietnam War. We're going to take a look at the development and the progress of the July 4th movement as the next element in our discussion of Meyer Kahane, tabbed by Robert Friedman as the false prophet. We're also going to take a look at another association of Meyer Kahane with the American far right and the intelligence community, namely Meyer Kahane's work or his testimony arranged for the House Un-American Activities Committee. The person who handled that was a fellow named Herbert Rahmerstein. And Rahmerstein also worked for the U.S. Information Agency in the 1980s and helped to, and in that context, was associated with the formation of the International Youth Year Commission, which the aforementioned Roy Godson later used as a conduit to help fund the Contras. We're also going to take a look at the use or at the activities of Meyer Kahane's Jewish Defense League against elements of the Black Power movement in the 1960s. Meyer Kahane's organization was used by the FBI, which, as accurately noted here by Robert Friedman, was expert at pitting extremist groups against one another. They were used as part of the COINTELPRO program against the Black Panthers, another extremist group which, like the JDL, I have no sympathies for. However, the breaches of constitutionality in combating elements like the Black Panther Party have left a legacy of lawlessness which haunts us to this day. So the participation of the JDL in the FBI's COINTELPRO program against the Black Panther Party will be the next item up in our discussion of Meyer Kahane. We're then going to take a look at the operational links between the Jewish Defense League of Meyer Kahane and Israeli intelligence and Menachem Begin, the successor to Vladimir Yabotinsky's Beitar. Among the activities the JDL engaged in addition to disrupting and spying on the Black Panther Party, was spying on Palestinian sympathizers here in the United States and then channeling the information to Israeli intelligence through the Menachem Begin forces within the Israeli government. After that, we're going to take a look at the role of Meyer Kahane's organization attempting to disrupt the mayoral primary campaign of former New York Mayor John Lindsay. John Lindsay ran as an independent Republican. Lindsay, despite his status as a Republican, was quite liberal and, in fact, had formed a very strong and effective multi-ethnic coalition in New York City. Lindsay was very sympathetic to the plight of minorities and people of color in New York City. And Menachem Begin's organization, Meyer Kahane's organization, was very active in attempting to disrupt and discredit John Lindsay's campaign. After that, we're going to take a look at the operational connections between the JDL and a former member of the Stern Gang, one of the explicitly fascist elements of the Zionist movement, in staging various terrorist acts against Soviet institutions here in the United States by way of, ostensibly at least, attempting to pressure the Soviet Union into either releasing its Jewish population so they could emigrate to Israel or, at the very least, providing them with better treatment. The net effect of this was to endanger the détente that was ongoing between the United States and the Soviet Union. It provoked the USSR and also led, for a time at least, to a crackdown by the Soviet authorities on Soviet Jewry. The point being that the operations of the JDL actually served the agenda of the American far right and served to provoke the Soviet Union and disrupt détente. By the way, those activities were frowned on by Golda Meir's labor government in Israel. Interestingly enough, two of the key contact people between the ILRRJ, the organization that enlisted the services of the Jewish Defense League, were Richard Perl and a fellow named Richard Perl, P-E-R-L-E, who was an aide to a former U.S. Senator from Washington, Scoop Jackson. Perl was a top Pentagon aide in the Reagan administration. One of the central themes of the discussion of Meyer Kahane's organization that we're going to be looking at concerns the strong and ongoing connections between the extreme right-wing milieu of Ronald Reagan and the milieu of Meyer Kahane. Interestingly enough, the Knesset member Geula Cohen that sort of requisitioned Meir Kahane as a tool against the Soviet Union was, as I said, a former member of the Stern Gang, an ultra-militant member, element of the Zionist movement that advocated, at least for a time, a wartime alliance between Nazi Germany and the Zionist movement in order to drive the British out of Palestine. After taking a look at the activities of the JDL in putting pressure on the Soviet Union and endangering detente, we're going to take a look at the observations of a fellow named Barry Lieben, the head of the Beitar movement, the successor to Jabotinsky. Barry Lieben, or Lieben, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, L-E-I-B-E-N, said in no uncertain terms that Meir Kahane was the new Vladimir Jabotinsky, the new head of the fascist element of the Zionist movement. After that, we're going to take a look at some really strange bedfellows. We're going to take a look at the alliance in the early 1970s between the Jewish Defense League of Meir Kahane and the Italian-American Civil Rights League. That was headed up by New York mob boss Joseph Colombo Sr. And in fact, those two organizations formed a very powerful working relationship in the early 1970s. We're going to look at, among other things, the comparison by defenders of the JDL-IACRL alliance of that particular alliance to, surprise, surprise, Vladimir Jabotinsky's alliance with Benito Mussolini, the fascist dictator of Europe. And we're going to close our examination of Meir Kahane by examining the flight of the Kahane organization to Israel under pressure. Of course, the Kahane organization took root in Israel, and it was a follower of Meir Kahane, the late Baruch Goldstein, who massacred a number of Muslim worshippers at the Cave of the Patriarchs, or the Mosque of the Patriarchs, imitating the style and methodology of Otto Skorzeny, the Hitler commando chief, who in many ways was the methodological and also operational godfather of international terrorism. The methodology employed by Baruch Goldstein, again, a member of the Kahane organization, or the Kahane allied forces in Israel, was identical to the terrorist methodology that has been utilized by the more extreme elements of the Palestinian national movement, themselves directly and inextricably linked with the fascist powers of Europe. That is why I have termed this particular archive show Strange Bedfellows, and we will be making a major, major addition to that this evening as we take a look at not only the Kahane organization as the political successor to the Beitar and the Stern Gang, but we will take a look at the strong operational links between the Kahane organization and the successor elements to the Stern Gang and the Beitar, as well as the profound operational links between elements of the American far right associated with the Reagan administration and the JDL, and also the strong connections, historical and operational, between U.S. intelligence and Meir Kahane and his organization. That, in a nutshell, is what we have on tap for this evening. We're going to take a musical break, and when we come back, we're going to be delving into the main body of the prepared portion of One Step Beyond Music, and then the main body of the prepared portion. It's time now for the main body of the prepared portion of tonight's program, and I'm going to begin by touching on a book which is itself on the same subject as a very important miscellaneous archive show entitled Euthanasia and Birth Control in Contemporary America and... No, actually, it's just Euthanasia in Contemporary America and Nazi Germany. That was done in March of 1988. It details the very profound connections between the international mental hygiene movement, the international eugenics movement, and the international euthanasia movement. The euthanasia program in Germany gave rise to the Tiergartenstrasse 4 program, which led directly to the Nazi extermination programs against Jews, gays, and others. That's a very, very important archive show, and one of the central elements of that archive show is the profound connections between American intellectuals, American scientific and intellectual thinkers, and their counterparts in Germany who were the intellectual advocates of, and intellectual godfathers, so to speak, of the Nazi extermination programs. There's a very important new book, which was given to me by a listener, on that very subject, and I strongly recommend that listeners get a hold of it. The book is called The Nazi Connection. It's subtitled Eugenics, American Racism, and German National Socialism. It's authored by Stefan Kuhl, K-U-Umlaut H-L. It's published in hardcover by the Oxford University Press, copyrighted 1994. And I'm going to read the notes on the jacket liner here by way of giving people a thumbnail synopsis of this particular book. When Hitler published Mein Kampf in 1924, he held up a foreign law as a model for his program of racial purification, the U.S. Immigration Restriction Act, which prohibited the immigration of those with hereditary illnesses and entire ethnic groups. When the Nazis took power in 1933, they installed a program of eugenics, the attempted, quote, improvement, unquote, of the population through forced sterilization and marriage controls that consciously drew on the U.S. example. By then, many American states had long had compulsory sterilization laws for, quote, defectives, unquote, upheld by the Supreme Court in 1927. Small wonder that the Nazi laws led one eugenics activist in Virginia to complain, quote, the Germans are beating us at our own game, unquote. In The Nazi Connection, Stefan Kuhl uncovers the ties between the American eugenics movement and the Nazi program of racial hygiene, showing that many American scientists actively supported Hitler's policies. After introducing us to the recently resurgent problem of scientific racism, Kuhl carefully recounts the history of the eugenics movement both in the United States and internationally, demonstrating how widely the idea of sterilization as a genetic control had become accepted by the early 20th century. From the first, American eugenicists led the way with radical ideas. Their influence led to sterilization laws in dozens of states, laws which were studied carefully by the German racial hygienists. With the rise of Hitler, the Germans enacted compulsory sterilization laws, partly based on the U.S. experience, and American eugenicists took pride in their influence on Nazi policies. Kuhl recreates astonishing scenes of American eugenicists traveling to Germany to study the new laws, publishing scholarly articles lionizing the Nazi eugenics program, and proudly comparing personal notes from Hitler thanking them for their books. Even after the outbreak of war, he writes, the American eugenicists frowned upon Hitler's totalitarian government, but not his sterilization laws. By 1945, when the murderous nature of the Nazi government was made perfectly clear, the American eugenicists sought to downplay the close connections between themselves and the Nazi program. Some of them, in fact, had sought to distance themselves from Hitler even before the war. But Stefan Kuhl's deeply documented book provides a devastating indictment of the influence and aid provided by American scientists for the most comprehensive attempt to enforce racial purity in world history. Well, indeed, with the euthanasia movement gathering support here in the United States, and bear in mind that it was the euthanasia movement in Germany, the government-sponsored euthanasia movement that eventually gave rise to the extermination programs conducted out of the Tiergartenstrasse 4 unit, with people on the American far right, many of them explicitly fascist, railing against, quote, immigrants, unquote, and insisting that various groups or categories of people be barred from immigrating with, or from emigrating to the United States, with immigrants being scapegoated for various problems here in the United States. Just take a look at what Pete Wilson, the governor of California, is saying as I speak to you on this date of April 24th, 1994. Take a look at what's going on in Germany right now. Take a look at the vicious attacks and the scapegoating of immigrants for Germany's economic problems. Indeed, the contemporary political situation is horrifyingly reminiscent of certain aspects of the pre-World War II period, and I think the very important lesson that is to be learned from this very important new book by Stefan Kuhl, and again, a tip of the hat to the listener who sent me this particular book, the lessons to be learned from it are only too important and only too relevant to the contemporary situation. Once again, The Nazi Connection, Eugenics, American Racism, and German National Socialism, authored by Stefan Kuhl, published in hardcover by the Oxford University Press, copyright 1994. Last week I read a column from the San Francisco Chronicle. It appeared on the op-ed page. That column was by Frank Viviano, a European correspondent for the Chronicle. That particular column was entitled The New Iron Fist That Was Rising in Europe, or words very much to that effect. It dealt with the rise of European, or the reemergence of the fascism in Europe. I noted that the column was accurate in every respect except that it talked about a new iron fist rising in Europe. That iron fist is anything but new. It's been around a long time. It has just been eclipsed. I noted in the supplemental discussion to my reading of that column that over a period of time, and I've been on the air almost 15 years at this stage of the game, over a period of time, the developments that are appearing even in the mainstream press as well as columns that are appearing in the editorial page or on the editorial page or the op-ed pages of American newspapers, including mainstream papers, have increasingly come to echo the points that I have been making for many, many years. I noted last week that when I first went on the air in the fall of 1979, warning that this country and this world were descending into fascism, people looked at me like I had a penis growing out of my head. They did not want to hear about it. Well, unfortunately, they may not have wanted to hear about it, but they're not going to have much of a choice. Even those who would emulate the ostriches and stick their heads into their sand, into the sand, or perhaps stick their heads into something else a little warmer and a little more secure, they will not be able to ignore political and physical reality for too very much longer. Indeed, as I noted last week, and as I will note again this week, the editorial pages, the headlines, the op-ed columns of even the mainstream press are increasingly come to echo the points that I have been making for almost 15 years. In that context, take note of the following. I'm reading now from the San Francisco Examiner op-ed page of Monday, April 18th of 1994. This is a column by Lance Gay, G-A-Y, who is described here as the European correspondent for Scripps Howard News Service. The column is datelined Amsterdam. It's headlined Germans, the Uninvited Guests of D-Day. It's subtitled, No One Wants to Admit That Germany Won World War II. And it reads in part as follows. And once again, note the subhead here. No one wants to admit that Germany won World War II. Public ceremonies at war memorials are designed to bury the past, not dig it up. But Europe's capitals are now dusting off their helmets, fatigues, and battle flags as World War II is revisited for the golden anniversary of the Allied invasion of Europe. The dirty little secret that no one here wants to admit is that Germany is the odds-on winner of World War II. That's why no one wants to invite Germany to celebrations of the invasion of Normandy 50 years ago on June 6, 1944. Like war veterans everywhere, the Allies are happier with their dusty memories and war stories when the Hun was hated and everyone had nothing to give but blood, sweat, toil, and tears. British politicians, who are ferried around in limos made by a German firm, can't admit they've been humbled by Germany. Nor can the imperious French, who these days wait out nervously each monthly meeting in Frankfurt of the Bundesbank to decide whether French interest rates will be raised or cut. Belgium's newspapers are using the anniversary to recount how so many of its citizens collaborated with the Germans as they swept through the lowlands towards Paris in 1940. The only ones complaining openly about Germany's victory are the Greeks, who contend that Germany is using its D-mark to, quote, create a Fourth Reich, unquote. Greek Foreign Minister Theodore Panagoulos, P-A-N-A-G-L-O-S, provoked an uproar by describing Germany as, quote, having bestial strength but the mind of a child, unquote. As much as Europe's politicians may resent it, Germany is now Europe's supreme power. Germany's treasury is bankrolling European Union because it's the only country with the resources left to do it as the superpowers retreat from the Cold War. Last year, the Germans were persuaded to drop 50th anniversary celebrations of the rocketry shots, signaling man's first venture into space, after the British protested they brought back bad memories of the robot bombs that terrorized London. And now, France is mired in the war crimes trial of Paul Cuvier, reminding France how it, too, collaborated under the Vichy regime. The Germans desperately wanted to come to the D-Day commemoration. France is happy to take the D-marks, but that doesn't mean Germans are fit yet to be accepted in civilized company. After all, the Germans didn't liberate Utah Beach, the French note. They occupied it. Well, yes, indeed, and as noted quite accurately here, rereading the third paragraph of this very important column, the dirty little secret that no one here wants to admit is that Germany is the odds-on winner of World War II. Well, in 1992, specifically from July 26th of 1992 through October 18th of 1992, I put together a massive archive show entitled How the United States Lost the Second World War. I consider that, frankly, to be my finest piece of work, and I think it merits serious consideration as the definitive political document of this century, at the risk of seeming a trifle conceited, and I apologize to those of you who feel that way. The fact of the matter is, however, that the United States did lose World War II, and Germany did win it. And as I stated, in Radio Free America 37, I am in no way speaking figuratively. I'm not talking, of course, about a battlefield military victory, but rather a political victory and a strategic victory which has led to an economic victory. And the long-term results of that victory are very likely to be very similar to the long-term results of a victory by Hitler's armies in World War II. Indeed, as noted in this column, as noted in the very important Stefan Kuhl book, The Nazi Connection, and as noted in numerous archive shows, including the archive shows that will be coming up on Memorial Day weekend, May 29th, fascism is not something foreign to Germany. Fascism, on the contrary, is something that has taken root for decades now in many countries, including the United States. And the fascist elements of many of the countries that were either conquered by the Germans in World War II or, like the United States, conquered by the Germans after World War II, were conquered by virtue of the collaboration of the fascist elements in those countries with the fascism of Germany. And indeed, I think many of the collaborationist elements in this country have yet to fully grasp the dimensions of their own failure. I suspect many of them consider themselves to be victors. They may be admirers of Adolf Hitler. They may concur with Hitler's racial policies. But they do not yet understand the dimensions of their own failure and their own defeat, for they are destined to become German lackeys. Once again, I strongly, strongly recommend to members of the listening audience that they get a hold of Radio Free America program number 37, an addendum to which I made a couple of weeks ago when I went into the long article from the Washington Quarterly about, surprise, surprise, the Bundesbank. Note again, sixth paragraph of this column, that nor can the imperious French, who these days wait out nervously each monthly meeting in Frankfurt of the Bundesbank to decide whether French interest rates will be raised or cut. As noted in that W.R. Smizer article from the Washington Quarterly, the Bundesbank has a great deal to do with whether American interest rates get raised or cut. And the influence of the Bundesbank on American monetary policy and in turn the American economy is central to the essence of the German victory in World War II. It was obviously not a battlefield military victory, but rather by virtue not only of the collaboration of fascist elements in the United States, but by virtue of the incorporation of the Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit into the very heart of the U.S. national security establishment, the Germans did in fact win a very real victory, albeit so far at least a limited victory in World War II. The archive, the aforementioned Radio Free America 37, is a massive archive show, well over 40 hours of documentation and supplemental discussion real time. I strongly recommend that members of the listening audience get a hold of that archive show. This particular column will be entered into the archives as a supplement to Radio Free America 37. This again from the San Francisco Examiner of Monday, April 18th, 1994. Germans, the uninvited guests of D-Day by Lance Gay, European correspondent for Scripps Howard News Services, subtitled, No One Wants to Admit That Germany Won World War II. Germany won World War II, huh? Huh. Imagine that. Ain't that a bitch. We're going to take a look at a story that we have dealt with at considerable length in the past, both with information from the Germany Alert newsletter and in our interviews with Professor Wilhelm Stauffer of Stauffer Consultants. We're going to read now about the city of Kaliningrad. That is a Russian city, formerly the capital of East Prussia. It has been the object of German covert operations, specifically activity by the BND, the German Intelligence Service, the successor to the aforementioned Reinhard Gehlen spy outfit, the Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit, which jumped to the CIA and became its Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs at the end of World War II. That organization represented a direct projection of the Third Reich's National Security Establishment and General Staff into the very core of the U.S. National Security Establishment, and in turn established it at the very core of NATO. In the past, again, in the Germany Alert newsletter and also in our discussions with Wilhelm Stauffer, we have dealt with the activity on behalf of BND, of BND, on behalf of Vladimir Zhirinovsky's Russian fascist movement in, obviously, Russia. Zhirinovsky has been, and his supporters have been quite willing to turn Kaliningrad over to the Germans, and the BND and their associated elements in turn have been very active in promoting the cause of German nationalism in Kaliningrad. And many Russians of German extraction have been moving to Kaliningrad, thus adding to the impetus to have Kaliningrad eventually become part of Germany as part of a new Drang nach Osten, or drive to the east. That was one of the central features of Adolf Hitler's foreign policy. It is one of the central features of a current German policy. It was, so far at least, the only difference being that instead of Mark IVs and Mark V tanks leading the spearhead, now it is the D-Marks that are leading the spearhead. Perhaps that will change. Who knows? Reading now from the New York Times of Friday, April 22nd of 1994. This is an article by Celestine Bohlen, B-O-H-L-E-N. It's datelined Kaliningrad, Russia. Its headline is City Acquiring a German Accent? Subtitled Kaliningrad Journal. It reads in part as follows. For half a century, Kaliningrad had no past. It was captured by the Red Army in 1945 and held as war booty. Now, there's a slight misprint here. Let me begin this again. For half a century, Kaliningrad had no past. It was captured by the Red Army in 1945 and held as war booty. The city's 700-year history as Königsberg, the capital of East Prussia, was never even mentioned in the great Soviet encyclopedia. Even manhole covers bearing the emblem of the ruined German city were removed. This ruthless self-denial still haunts Kaliningrad, now an isolated outpost of a shrunken Russia. Perched on the Baltic coast, just a few hours' train ride from the Polish port of Gdansk, Kaliningrad, a region with a population of 900,000, finds itself separated from the rest of the Russian Federation by more than 600 miles and two independent countries, Lithuania and Belarus. Its population is overwhelmingly Russian, and yet its German origins, now openly acknowledged once again, have added uncertainty about its future. No matter how much local officials deny it, the possibility that Kaliningrad may again become German lingers like an old sore. Quote, "There is no Germanization of Kaliningrad. It has not happened, it is not happening, and it will not happen," unquote, said Vitaly Shipov, S-H-I-P-O-V, the mayor. Quote, "It is a made-up issue," unquote. Skipping down, "But no matter how small the numbers of German settlers or German investment, these trends make some people here nervous." Quote, "Among the older generation in Kaliningrad, many of them veterans, there is a kind of an allergy to any German presence," unquote, said Irina Kuznetsova, deputy head of the regional administration. By the way, her name, Irina, I-R-I-N-A, Kuznetsova, K-U-Z-N-E-T-S-O-V-A. Quote, "What in the other parts of Russia is now a painless issue is still painful here," unquote. The rise of Russian nationalism, which gave Vladimir V. Zhirinovsky his strong showing in the Russian elections in December, has made all these questions even more delicate. Quote, "The local government has to be careful not to chase voters over to Zhirinovsky," unquote, Mr. Neufeld said. That's N-E-U-F-E-L-D-T. The region's future is a source of unease not only among Russians in Kaliningrad, but also among its neighbors. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia's military presence here has increased to an estimated 200,000 troops. Quote, "This is a region that cannot stand on its own," unquote, Mr. Neufeld said, again quoting, "Right now, the Russians want to make it like an aircraft carrier, while its neighbors have to make sure not only that there is no military threat from here, but also that the Russians are not living in fear." One of the central elements of Radio Free America program number 37 was the analysis of the evolution of rollback or liberation theory in American national security life in the second half of the 20th century. Rollback or liberation theory began as a German political warfare and covert action strategy formulated by Alfred Rosenberg's Ostministerium in the Third Reich, with the incorporation of the Reinhard Gehlen spy organization into the United States and the propagandizing of rollback or liberation theory in the United States as a result of the Crusade for Freedom. That was a CIA domestic media campaign, also as a result of the incorporation of Galen alumni into the United States as spokespersons for rollback or liberation theory. Rollback or liberation theory eventually became a dominant element of American political and national security thinking as well. It saw its serious birth in the United States as a result of the Crusade for Freedom in 1952. It saw its strategic triumph in American power politics as a result of the assassination of President Kennedy in 1963. It saw its ultimate culmination and international fulfillment in the 1980s and 1990s under the administrations of Ronald Reagan and George Bush. Indeed, the Reagan and Bush administrations represented the culmination of the principles, or the actualization and culmination of the principles and stratagems that were formulated in NSC 68. And eventually, communism, quote, socialism, whatever you want to call it, was indeed rolled back. Not only was Eastern Europe taken out from under Soviet domination, but the Soviet Union itself, as advocated by Rosenberg's Ostministerium, was broken up into its constituent ethnic republics, and the way is now cleared for Germany to reassert its influence, not only in Eastern Europe, but inside of some of the former, some of the independent countries that were former republics of the Soviet Union. What we are seeing now in Kaliningrad, with a BND activity in that particular city, and what we are seeing with the German support for Vladimir Zhirinovsky, is the fruits of rollback or liberation theory, or the ultimate results of that, although it was the United States that, in effect, bankrupted itself, thereby placing itself to a large extent under German economic influence in order to finance the enormous deficits that were run up by those fiscal conservatives, Ronald Reagan and George Bush. As a result of the activities of the 1980s and 1990s, Germany is not only free internationally to begin reoccupying, at least economically and politically, parts of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, but we are seeing very strong German economic support and covert action on behalf of Vladimir Zhirinovsky, the Russian fascist. Indeed, some of the elements that are supporting Vladimir Zhirinovsky, such as Gerhard Fry's Deutsche Volksunion, represent direct links from the days of the Third Reich on up through the period of the Cold War and into the post-Cold War period. Now, I can appreciate that newer listeners may be wondering just what in the hell I'm talking about with all of this. That is why I recommend the archive shows, and in this context, I strongly recommend Radio Free America 37. It will not be cheap. It will not be easy to listen to, or at least it will not be quickly absorbed. It is massive in length. However, it is critical, and I think it merits serious consideration as the most important, perhaps even the definitive political document of the 20th century. That is not an idle boast, and for those of you with the stomach to handle that massive, massive fare, well, I think you will find that it lives up to its billing. Last week we touched on a speech, a rare condemnation of German activity by an American diplomat, although one who was about to retire. That diplomat was a fellow named Douglas H. Jones, and there was an element in Douglas Jones' indictment of Germany that was not carried in the Bay Area papers. I read an article from the San Francisco Chronicle, also cited an article from the San Francisco Examiner. Oh, by the way, that last article was from the New York Times of Friday, April 22nd of 1994. This article is also from the New York Times. However, it's from the New York Times of April 19th of 1994. This article is datelined at Berlin, April 18th. It's by Stephen Kinzer, K-I-N-Z-E-R, of the New York Times. Its headline, U.S. Diplomat's Speech on Extremism in Germany Sets Off Storm. It reads in part as follows. An unusually frank speech by a senior American diplomat about right-wing extremism in Germany has stirred a tempest here. The diplomat, Douglas H. Jones, who heads the American diplomatic mission in Berlin, told an audience last week that many foreigners believe that Germany, quote, lacks the will to confront its extremism problem pragmatically, unquote. Again quoting, it is not reassuring, for example, that more progress is not being made toward guaranteed civil rights for foreigners in Germany, unquote, he said, skipping down. Mr. Jones also criticized a recent proposal made by Wolfgang Schäuble, the parliamentary leader of Mr. Kohl's Christian Democratic Union, that the German army be used to maintain civil order in the country. Quote, I can think of nothing that would bring to mind worse associations or that would give more of an impression of a state in crisis than this blurring of the distinction between internal and external security, unquote, he said. In our discussions with Professor Wilhelm Stauffer, we went into the constitutional changes being effected in Germany, including the proposal to permit the army to enforce domestic security. That also was alluded to by the diplomat, the aforementioned Douglas Jones. This was not carried in the Bay Area papers. I would also note the following article following that, a misleading article indeed. This article is datelined Bonn, April 18th. It's headlined, Attacks Drop Slightly. Right-wing attacks of violence in Germany dropped slightly last year compared with 1992, according to a report by the German government. Well, we have seen again in our the discussions with Professor Wilhelm Stauffer that, in fact, right-wing attacks have not dropped, rather due to the complicity of the police and the judicial authorities in Germany, and also to the government itself. The figures have been fudged. Crimes which were explicitly hate crimes have been classified as other than hate crimes or other than Nazi crimes by the judicial authorities and the police. And beyond that, the government itself stopped tabulating the number of attacks at the end of June of 1993. So, of course, the attacks dropped slightly. The number of months in the year dropped by 50%, according to the German calculations. And it is very disturbing that we are not seeing reportage about that. And indeed, the critical importance of the interviews with Wilhelm Stauffer are highlighted by that particular piece of disinformation.